Chapter 4. From Queen of Heaven to Devil Woman. The thousand years or so separating the end of the classical world and the rise of the modern witnessed the development of two seemingly contradictory processes, the beatification of woman and her demonization. The Middle Ages would begin by elevating women towards heaven and end by consigning many thousands of them to hell. In the latter case, however, the process was more than mystical or metaphorical. The flames were all too real. It marked an extraordinary period when the human imagination soared with the great spires of the Gothic cathedrals of France that seemed to scrape the very floors of heaven. It was a period, too, when the human spirit was convulsed by outbreaks of mass hysteria, pogroms, and witch hunts that plunged it into some of the most hellish regions it has ever visited. In AD 431, the highest council of the Catholic Church declared that Mary, a Jewish peasant girl from Palestine, was the Mother of God. The girl, about whom, historically speaking, almost nothing was known apart from her name, was not just the mother of a god, and in the classical world, gods were as plentiful as celebrities are in modern times. She was the mother of the only god, the creator of the entire universe. The other gods had been banished or transformed by St. Augustine into demons, leaving the Christian god to loom over the cosmos in solitary majesty. Mary was his mother, or Theotokos, the god-bearer. Because of this unique claim, Mary would play not only an unprecedented role in the history of religion, but a vital and determining part in the history of misogyny. The proclamation by the gathering of bishops came after a heated debate, in which crowds, pro and anti Mary's elevation to Theotokos, demonstrated on the streets of Ephesus where the council met, the ancient city on the eastern coast of what is now Turkey. It was renowned for being the centre of the worship of the virgin goddess Diana, whose temple there had been one of the seven wonders of the ancient world before an army of Goths destroyed it in the upheavals of the 3rd century. One of those most actively involved in the controversy was St. Cyril of Alexandria, something of an expert at exciting mobs. His fiery sermon 16 years earlier had provoked a Christian mob to skin alive the woman pagan philosopher Hypatia. This time, however, St. Cyril was ardently in favour of promoting woman, in the form of Mary, to the highest elevation imaginable, and excommunicated Nestorius, the bishop of Constantinople, who had pointed out that since God had existed forever, it was impossible for Mary, or any woman, however virtuous and miraculous, to have been his mother. Nestorius was concerned that declaring Mary Theotokos elevated her to the status of a goddess and smacked of paganism. Perhaps on his way to the council meetings, held in the Church of the Virgin Mary, he had glanced up at the remains of Diana's temple and worried that the Catholic Church was in danger of replacing one virgin goddess with another. Some 50 years before, another learned mustering of ecclesiastics had already declared Mary a perpetual virgin. In any case, Cyril's victory was popular with the masses, who held a candlelit procession through the ancient streets to celebrate Mary, the Mother of God. The persistence of their devotion to Mary has proven to be one of the most remarkable and enduring features of Catholicism. In 1950, 1,431 years after the Council of Ephesus, enormous crowds of the faithful, said to be a million strong, would gather in St. Peter's Square in Rome to greet Pope Pius XII's proclamation of the dogma of Mary's Assumption into Heaven with outbursts of hymn-singing, tears, and joyous prayers. In the meantime, the Jewish peasant girl from Palestine would find her name on 28 churches in Rome and many thousands more elsewhere, as well as being the inspiration of some of the greatest works of architecture and art, including poetry and song, the world has produced. The debate over Mary's status was originally a byproduct of the rancorous controversies surrounding the status of her son, Jesus. The bishops were trying to settle questions about his nature. Should it be defined as human, divine, or some combination of both? The Orthodox Church eventually rejected the two extremes of the argument, that Jesus was either human or divine, in favour of a complex compromise under the term consubstantiation. That is, Jesus as the Son of God was consubstantial with his Father, sharing his divine nature, and at the same time was consubstantial with the flesh, that is, partaking fully of human nature. The status of Mary, like that of any mother, rose with that of her son. The Gospels had already described her as a virgin. By the 5th century, the Church decided she was a virgin before, during, and after her son's birth. Once Jesus' consubstantial nature with God was established, it was only fitting that Mary should be declared God's mother. After that, her progress up the mythological ladder was unstoppable, at least until the Reformation of the 16th century. By that time, the cult of Mary had, in all its complex manifestations, replaced the Incarnation and the Resurrection as the focus of belief for the vast majority of Catholics. The 1,000 years between the Christianity of the Church Fathers and the climax of Mary's cult saw a shift away from the expectancy of the Second Coming and hopes for immediate redemption that had animated the faith's early followers. Though tremors of millenarianism shook the Middle Ages, especially as they drew to a close, the vast majority of the faithful did not expect redemption in this life and looked to Mary to console them for the arduous and painful passage through it to the next world. It was deemed unsuitable that the Mother of God should meet the fate of other mortals upon death. From AD 600 onwards, the Church celebrated the Feast of the Assumption on the 15th of August, when it was believed Mary was assumed bodily into heaven. She shares the almost unique privilege of defying human fate and existing in bodily form in paradise with Jesus. Once installed among the angels alongside her son, it was not long before Mary was to find herself crowned Queen of Heaven. Later, the question arose as to her own conception. It became unthinkable for some theologians of the Church that the perpetual Virgin, Mother of God and Queen of Heaven, should have been tainted with original sin, sharing our fall from divine grace, which is a direct consequence of our sexual lusts. Anxiety about the purity of the Mother of God being blotted by this aspect of the human condition troubled Duns Scotus back in the 14th century. But a firm decision on the matter had to wait another 500 years. In 1854, Pope Pius IX proclaimed the doctrine of Mary's Immaculate Conception, making her the only human being, aside from Jesus, to have escaped the taint of original sin. This meant that Mary was the only human being, again apart from Jesus, to have been conceived in perfection with no inbuilt tendency to sin. That is, she lived a life completely free of temptation, thus exceeding the state of perfection Adam and Eve had enjoyed in the Garden of Eden before the fall. It was indeed remarkable progress for a Jewish peasant girl from Palestine, especially considering the paucity of references to her in the Bible. The earliest source for our knowledge of Jesus, the Apostle Paul, does not even mention her by name, merely noting that Jesus was made of a woman. Galatians chapter 4, verse 4. Mark refers to her once by name, and once in the context of a rather dismissive exchange between Jesus and his brethren and his mother. Their pleas for his attention because they are family are swept aside. "Who is my mother or my brethren?" Jesus replies. Chapter 3, verse 33. He answers his own question by declaring that all those who followed him are his real family. John contains two references to Jesus' mother. She is more present in Matthew and Luke, who provide the narrative of Christ's nativity and infancy, upon which Christianity's rich tradition of Christmas is based. Even here, she is far from being centre stage. But the lack of detail did not prevent Christianity over the centuries, and the Catholic Church in particular, from placing on her shoulders the enormous weight of its most important dogmas. In fact, the very absence of scriptural tradition allowed for the proliferation of myths and legends about Mary that helped turn her into the most venerated woman in human history. The very core belief of Christianity, the Incarnation, rests on the claim that Mary was a virgin when she conceived. Claims of virgin births as a result of some divine intervention were, of course, not unusual in the ancient world as a way of establishing the exceptional nature of the person for whom the claim is made. Alexander the Great is one example, and Plato is another. But thanks to their profound rejection of the body as the devil's gateway into the world, the Christians had to protect the Mother of God from any suggestion that the experience leading to the miraculous event was in any way physical, that is, pleasurable. Therefore, sex could not be involved. The Redeemer cannot come into the world as a result of an act of filthy lust. As the 17th century theologian Francisco Suarez put it, The Blessed Virgin, in conceiving a son, neither lost her virginity nor experienced any venereal pleasure. It did not befit the Holy Spirit to produce such an effect or to excite any unbecoming movement of passion. On the contrary, the effect of his overshadowing is to quench the fire of original sin. The most venerated woman in the world could only be venerated on the grounds that she did not share with other women something so fundamental to their nature as the experience of sex. A woman was being exalted, yet at the cost of holding in contempt her sexuality. Mary, as Mother of God, was exempted from the pains as well as the pleasures of motherhood, and learned theologians of the early church debated how she might have produced Jesus without breaking her hymen. The alternative opinion that it did break, but was miraculously made whole again, was rejected. Thus began a long process that would make Mary increasingly abstract and distant from the experience of the women who looked up to her for some relief from the male-dominated Christian pantheon. The Word became flesh in the form of her son, Jesus, but the flesh of the woman who gave birth to him became an abstraction. In a sense, the abstraction of Mary through her elevation into a sexless, saccharine, goddess-like being, far beyond human nature, acted as a counterpoint to the Incarnation. The old dualism of body and spirit, threatened by the belief in the Incarnation, reasserted itself with the cult of the Virgin Mary. The Word became flesh signalled the end of dualism, but the cult of the Virgin Mary meant that the old contempt for matter was perpetuated. Even today, stepping into the marble cool and dimly lit interiors of the great basilicas dedicated to Mary leaves a visitor with the overwhelming sense of the otherworldliness of the Virgin Mother turned Heavenly Queen. In Santa Maria Maggiore, which legend says was founded between 352 and 366 by Pope Liberius I, the Queen of Heaven, gorgeously arrayed in cloth of gold and pearls, sits on a luxuriously cushioned couch as, with hands slightly raised and an almost expressionless face, she accepts the crown from Jesus. Across the Tiber, in the even earlier Basilica of Santa Maria in Trastevere, the Queen of Heaven is portrayed in an icon over 6 feet high. She sits on imperial cushions, her son Jesus next to her, a protective arm extended around her shoulder. A great diadem crowns her head, and a faint nimbus glows around her. Her long, narrow face carries an expression impassive, remote, and otherworldly, as she stares down from a plane of being far above that of mortal flesh and blood. The icons send out a complex, if not contradictory, message. They are, of course, intended to convey messages other than those relating to women. In an age when Rome was asserting its primacy over the other episcopates, the depictions conveyed a very clear signal that its status as capital of the Catholic Church was divinely sanctioned. But if we look at what they tell us about the status of women, we find that while a woman is exalted, like no human being has ever been before, reigning over the very Pope, crowned by the King of Heaven, she is not the agent of her own exaltation. And the cause of her elevation to the highest is her very passivity, "Behold the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to thy word," Luke chapter 1 verse 38, and asexuality. As a role model for women, Mary set contradictory, if not downright impossible, standards for them to meet, representing as she did the apotheosis of passivity, obedience, motherhood, and virginity. Indeed, she served as a constant reminder that women were inadequate because of their own very human nature. Her sexlessness was a rebuke to their sexuality, her obedience an encouragement to believe that the norms of social relationships had divine sanction, her virgin motherhood a miraculous state beyond the reach of merely human females. That is, she is a specific rebuke to women in a way that Jesus is not to men. Jesus' suffering and death rebuke all of humankind and are not aimed specifically at men, the way the Church used Mary's elevation to target the rest of the female sex for denigration. In Catholic imagery to this day, her foot remains firmly planted on the serpent's head, a call to Catholic girls and women to repress desire in themselves and deny its fulfilment in their menfolk. The only way that women could hope to emulate her was by forswearing their sexuality. In the early years of Christianity, thousands of women did so by taking up the ascetic life, usually by converting a private house or villa into a retreat. By AD 800, some 400 years after the proclamation that Mary was the Mother of God, the movement had become institutionalized, and convents, monasteries, and priories were a common feature throughout Europe. Women's energy and commitment that had contributed so much to the rise of Christianity were not rewarded through the granting of any role in the power structures of the Church. Instead, they were now channeled into the great monastic institutions, which for the first time in history offered large numbers of women an alternative to marriage and childbearing, albeit at the price of accepting lifelong chastity and other restrictions, part of an often harsh way of life. But it was a price many thousands of women were prepared to pay. By the 11th century, convents had become a major educational resource for women, where they learned to read and write, and where they could become acquainted with learning and the classics. As of 1250, in Germany alone, there were some 500 nunneries, holding between 25,000 and 30,000 women. They spent their time praying, meditating, and working in wool and linen. It was the nuns of Normandy who sewed the beautiful Bayeux tapestry, commemorating the Norman victory over the Anglo-Saxon King Harold at the Battle of Hastings in England in 1066. They also embroidered the garments for the priests and bishops, a task many nuns still perform. During this period, women were also able to oversee the institutions as abbesses, and a few rose to powerful positions. Abbesses could find themselves ruling over men in joint communities such as that founded by St. Farah in Brie in northern France. She and others even heard confessions. Nuns in the Abbey of Las Huelgas in Spain appointed their own confessors. However, by the beginning of the 13th century, such freedom and independence were in decline. Many of the abbeys lost their lands, and control became increasingly centralized. Pope Innocent III, 1198-1216, who launched the crusade against the Cathars in Languedoc, imposed prohibitions on women's role in the church. Joint communities were abolished, a move welcomed in misogynistic fashion by one abbot who wrote, "We and our whole community of canons, recognizing that the wickedness of women is greater than all the other wickedness of the world, and that there is no anger like that of women, and that the poison of asps and dragons is more curable and less dangerous to men than the familiarity of women, have unanimously decreed for the safety of our souls, no less than that of our bodies and goods, that we will on no account receive any more sisters to the increase of our petition, but will avoid them like poisonous animals." Although women were never ordained priests, the priesthood was not officially closed to them until the 13th century. St. Thomas Aquinas issued his opinion that women cannot be in authority over men, and that the superior male essence was necessary to become a priest, for Adam was beguiled by Eve, not she by him. It was necessary for the priest, therefore, to be male, so that he did not fall a second time through her female levity. In future, only priests could hear confessions, and since only men could be priests, women would be forced to confess any sexual transgressions to often lascivious and frustrated males who frequently exploited their power. By the beginning of the following century, the world of the great abbesses was a thing of the past, but the early Middle Ages allowed other outlets for women of energy, talent, and status. Eleanor of Aquitaine, 1122-1204, wife of Louis VII of France, and later Henry II, Plantagenet, the future King of England, was the richest heiress of Western Christendom and the presiding genius of courtly culture. The women of southwestern France enjoyed some of the benefits of Roman law, which persisted in what had been the Roman province of Aquitania, including the right to inherit property. Eleanor's inheritance, comprising of most of southern France, stretched south from the Loire Valley to the Mediterranean Sea, and west to the Atlantic coast of Bordeaux. It was there, during her reign, that the culture of courtly love, celebrated in the work of the troubadour poets, reached its peak. Between 1150 and 1250, some 200 troubadour poets whom we know by name flourished, 20 of them women. They were poets from noble families, who introduced to their aristocratic patrons the refinements of wit and elegant verse. Most importantly, they celebrated a new code of chivalrous conduct in the relationship between high-ranking men and women. The courtly love tradition was an attack upon the clerical misogyny that dominated the Church's attitude towards women, with its unrelenting and obsessive denigration of the female as filthy matter. It did so by exalting love between man and woman. Woman was seen as man's saviour. In terms of Western civilization, this was completely novel. Classical poets had sung the praises of their mistresses, but there was no tradition of elevating woman to the status of the universal beloved object. The worship of Mary as Queen of Heaven had established a precedent, but the courtly love poets celebrated illicit love, mocked marriage, and defied prevailing Christian morality. They came close to heresy. The troubadour Renaud de Beaujeu, in Le Bel Inconnu, refutes the Bible by claiming that man was created to serve woman, from whom all good flows. Speaking of Eleanor's court, the historian Friedrich Herr wrote, "The essence of love, as taught at Poitiers, was not the indulgence of uncontrollable passion, but the moulding of passion by a man's lady, his mistress." According to Herr, a revolution in romantic relationships was not all that was achieved in the south of France. He believes that there is some evidence to suggest that women may also have had the right to vote and took part in the elections to the local government. The elevation of love between man and woman to a sacrament anticipates the work of Dante Alighieri, 1265-1321. Dante's meeting with Beatrice Portinari transfigures his life. In her, he sees the apotheosis of goodness and beauty. The encounter inspired his first work, La Vita Nuova. In his masterpiece, The Divine Comedy, written after Beatrice had married a Florentine merchant and died at the early age of 24, he tells of the journey the poet takes through the three kingdoms of hell, purgatory, and paradise. It is Beatrice who escorts him from purgatory to paradise. As she comes to him in a green mantle, a garland of olives on her head, he remembers his love for her. Dantico amor senti la gran potenza. I felt the great power of the old love. But this is not the adulterous love of the troubadours. Dante's love for Beatrice is chaste, and his salvation depends upon it. However, what is remarkable about his vision is that it implies no disregard of or contempt for what is human, no triumph of spirit over matter. Beatrice is both. Though exalted, she remains a very human figure. In the words of Marina Warner, Dante was too profound and noble a thinker to fall into dualism and use the perfection of Beatrice to denigrate the human race or the rest of the female sex. Such a vision of woman as both human and an expression of beauty with the power to transfigure others could not counter the misogynistic currents running through Christianity. By the time Dante had completed his work, those currents were beginning to run more strongly. They would become a raging torrent. The Church, always disapproving of the courtly love tradition, discovered that the land of the troubadours was home not only to seditious and disturbing ideas about women, but to a major heresy, Catharism. A large section of the population had abandoned the Catholic Church altogether in favour of a movement that rejected the world as evil and preached that the Pope and his bishops had forsaken the teachings of Jesus. The persecution of the Cathars linked heresy to ideas about women in a way that would facilitate the witch hunts of later centuries. The Cathar movement had originated in the East, cradle of many such dualistic faiths going back to before Christianity. Like earlier heresies, and indeed like early Christianity itself, it had shocked the Orthodox because of the prominent role women played in it. The Cathars allowed women to preach and to become part of the movement's spiritual elite, the Perfects. Wealthy women of Languedoc were among the most prominent of the patrons of Cathar preachers, as they were of troubadour poets. Pope Innocent III declared a crusade against Catharism in 1208. It was conducted savagely. Over a period of 30 years, hundreds of thousands were butchered, burned, and hanged, with Cathar women being singled out for special humiliation and abuse, as the fate of Lady Geralda, one of the most renowned of the Cathar women, grimly illustrates. After being taken prisoner, she was thrown down a well and stoned to death. "Even by the standards of the day, the act was shocking," commented one historian of the heresy. The crusade against the Cathars effectively wiped out the culture that had nourished the tradition of courtly love. Troubadours continued to write love poetry, but it was chastened and thoroughly Christianized. The purge against heresy became a purge against expressing certain ideas about the relationship between men and women. Poets now sang that the purity of love was defined by the denial of its own goal, the possession of the beloved. According to Warner, this was a concept which would have been nonsense to the early troubadours. The Mother of God and Queen of Heaven now emerges as part of the ideological struggle and acquires the title Notre Dame, Our Lady. The poets substitute love for one lady, Mary, for the ladies of the court. Gautier Duras, who came from northern France and wrote in disapproval of the spirit of Eleanor's court, proclaims, "Let us marry the Virgin Mary. No one can make a bad marriage with her," and casts disdain on the love of real women. Deification dehumanizes women as much as its polar opposite, demonization. Both deny women their ordinary humanity. However, that humanity is the theme of one of the greatest portraits of women ever written, which appeared around 1387 to light the gathering gloom of the waning of the Middle Ages. It gave voice, perhaps for the first time since the comedies of Aristophanes over 1,700 years earlier, to woman not as goddess or temptress, but as a human being with vices and virtues like any other. As portrayed in the Canterbury Tales of Geoffrey Chaucer, 1342-1400, Alison, the wife of Bath, is certainly no Beatrice. No man will find salvation through love for her. Nor is she an embodiment of the virtues of Mary. She does not try to be. Her vices, like her virtues, are rooted in the demands made upon her by the exigencies of everyday life. For Alison, men are a management problem, but one that she is confident can be solved by women who use their wits. More importantly, she protests against the history of misogyny and its injustice. In doing so, she denounces every misogynist from old Rome to the Bible, including Metellus, that filthy lout who beat his wife to death for drinking wine, and Gaius Sulpicius Gallus, who divorced his wife because she went out with her head uncovered. She is especially scathing on the church's tradition of defaming women. In The Wife of Bath's prologue, she speaks out, "For take my word for it, there is no libel on women that the clergy will not paint, except when writing of a woman's saint, but never good of other women, though. Who called the lion savage? Do you know? By God, if women had but written stories like those the clergy keep in oratories, more had been written of man's wickedness than all the sons of Adam could redress." Her husband, the fifth, infuriates her, constantly reading from his collection of misogynistic homilies. After a furious row, she persuades him to fling his book in the fire and to submit to her rule. The Wife of Bath's tale, which follows, is about an attempt to answer the question, made famous many centuries later by Sigmund Freud, "What do women want?" The hapless knight who is set the task of finding an answer fails until the solution is given to him by an old woman. A woman wants the self-same sovereignty over her husband as over her lover, and master him. He must not be above her. But for Alison, there was no real puzzle. Sovereignty meant freedom to be herself in all her womanly nature. The Wife of Bath's indignation about the misogyny of the church came just a few decades before it would take on its most deadly, indeed nightmarish, form. This was also prefigured in the misogynistic disdain for human sexuality expressed by Pope Innocent III, who exterminated the Cathars and the culture of courtly love. He proclaimed, "Man was formed from the itch of the flesh in the heat of passion and the stench of lust, and worse yet, with the stain of sin." The Pope saw the world as beset with evil. In 1215, at the Fourth Lateran Council, confession was made compulsory for all adult Catholics. This way, the Church could police the souls of the faithful more effectively. He ruled that women's role in the religious life be severely reduced. They were permanently barred from hearing confessions and preaching. Even their role in singing during service was to be restricted. In everyday life, women, too, were to be confined to the role of, in the words of St. Thomas Aquinas, man's helpmate. He advocated that men should make use of a necessary object, woman, who is needed to preserve the species or to provide food and drink. Brutal force employed by an absolutist church was the ultimate means of deterrence. Not until the totalitarian states of the 20th century was there an institution which could wield such power. Yet underlying it was a terrible insecurity. Cathars were not the only threat. The church ruled that Jews must wear a distinctive form of clothing, a yellow patch and a horned cap to mark them as the murderers of Christ. In the outbreaks of religious hysteria that became more common during this period, mobs turned upon Jewish communities in vicious pogroms. According to Herr, every abortion, animal or human, every fatal accident to a child, every famine and epidemic was presumed to be the work of an evildoer. Until they had been eliminated, the Jews were obvious culprits. Afterwards, it was women. Witches. The witch craze, which ran from the late 14th to the late 17th centuries and resulted in the deaths of unknown thousands of women, retains the ability to shock us largely because it is the only known instance in the history of persecution in which to be a woman was to be a chief suspect in a vast conspiracy and the grounds for imprisonment, torture and execution. It is the most deadly event in the history of misogyny, and still, after the lapse of many centuries, the most disturbing and perplexing. Throughout much of human history, right up until the present, people have believed in witches, both male and female, and saw their magic as capable of being exercised for benign as well as malign purposes. Periodically, witches were punished. But the early church believed that the incarnation had effectively vanquished Satan, and he was not seen as exercising a powerful influence over witches or anybody else. For the first millennium and more of Christianity, belief in witches was generally treated as a superstition of the ignorant, and the church warned against it. Usually, when witches were killed, it was at the hands of enraged or frightened peasants. The official position of the church remained that magic did exist, and some women and men could use it, in particular to bring about impotence and cause abortions. But it condemned as a sin the belief that witches could ride through the air at night, turn love for a person into hatred, transform themselves or others into animals, and have sex with demons. By the late 13th century, the mood had changed. A darker, more pessimistic attitude replaced this healthy caution, and theologians began reconsidering the status of the devil, his demons, and their human servants. Why? Heresies had already shaken the once sturdy edifice of Catholicism. They were followed by the pandemic of the Black Death, 1347-50, one of the greatest disasters ever to strike Europe. An estimated 20 million died. The world that emerged in its wake was one more full of dread and uncertainty. At the close of the Middle Ages, a sombre melancholy weighs on people's souls. The late medieval mood of pessimism, mixed with doubt and fear, expressed itself in a way that would have a direct impact on the fate of women. The growth in interest in demons, a need to prove that they were real, and therefore that the devil and his demons were abroad in the world. As the historian Walter Stevens summed it up, "Without proof of a devil, there can be no proof of God." The most convincing proof of the reality of demons would be their ability to interact with human beings. There is no more powerful and corporal form of interaction than sex. But to have sex, demons needed bodies. Many learned monks bent over ancient texts in bare cells burned the midnight oil, pondering the corporality of demons. The great authorities St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, 1225-74, were invoked for those who were in favour of devilish embodiment. Augustine had pointed to the pagan gods, who he believed were demons, and their fondness for raping and impregnating women as proof they could interact with humans. St. Thomas Aquinas believed demons were the supreme, supernatural gender-benders. They could appear as females, succubi, and go about extracting semen from men. Then they would transform themselves into male demons, or incubi, and impregnate women. The skeptics argued that demons were illusionary. To a modern reader, the whole debate over demon bodies and what demons could or could not do with them may seem remote from the concerns about the status of women. But the lives of many thousands of women would depend on its outcome. Abstract arguments often have concrete consequences, sometimes of the most horrifying kind. By the 14th century, the arguments for the reality of demons had won crucial support at the highest levels of the church. Pope John XXII, 1316-34, was obsessed with witchcraft and heresy, and he was a true believer in demons. It was during his long reign that for the first time in history a woman was accused of having sex with the devil. In 1324, Lady Alice Keitela of Kilkenny in Ireland earned that dubious distinction. The Pope had appointed Richard Ladreed as Bishop of Ossory in southeastern Ireland, a man who shared his obsessions. Lady Keitela was on her fourth husband when she was brought to the bishop's attention. Bishop Ladreed listened eagerly to accusations from the children of Lady Keitela's three dead husbands that she had used witchcraft to dispose of their fathers. She was also accused of running a sect that forswore Christianity, using the swaddling clothes of dead, unbaptized babies to concoct evil potions and poisons with which to harm good Catholics. Most sensationally of all, under torture, her maid Petronilla told the bishop how she acted as a go-between for the devil and her mistress. When the devil as lover first appears in history, he does so in the form of three big, handsome black men. Petronilla said she saw with her own eyes, and apparently she looked on frequently, Lady Alice making love with them, sometimes in broad daylight. After this disgraceful act, with her own hand, Petronilla wiped clean the disgusting place with sheets from her own bed. Lady Keitela was also accused of being the leader of an anti-Christian sect, thus linking witchcraft, demonic sex, and heresy. No longer would witches be seen as lonely women mixing potions in village cabins. They were becoming part of a vast conspiracy. Lady Keitela escaped to England and avoided punishment. But the unlucky Petronilla was burned alive. She was one of only two people, and the only woman, to be burned as a witch in Ireland. Accusations of witchcraft and demonic sex began to occur more frequently in the 15th century. They were a feature of the first wide-ranging witch hunt in the Rhône Valley in southern France in 1428, during which between 100 and 200 witches were burned. Less than 60 years later, a landmark text in the history of misogyny appeared to explain why it was that more and more women were apparently leaving the church and throwing themselves into the arms of Satan and his demons. It is not that Malleus Maleficarum, or Hammer of the Witches, 1487, has anything original to say about misogyny. It has not. It merely repeats all the abuse heaped upon women in the Bible and the classical authors. But what it does do for the first time is explicitly link the supposed weaknesses of women's nature to their propensity to fall for the devil and thus become witches. Its influence was hugely augmented by a new invention, the printing press. There is more than a little irony in the fact that the invention that would revolutionize people's access to information should be so instrumental in spreading one of the most lethal forms of ignorance, fear, and prejudice ever to manifest itself. Malleus was the work of two Dominican inquisitors, James Sprenger and Henry Kramer, though Kramer is thought to have been chiefly responsible for writing it. Sprenger had spent time as an inquisitor in Germany, but his main claim to fame was that before he occupied himself with burning women, he established in 1475 the Confraternity of the Holy Rosary, a form of devotion to the Virgin Mary, which even to this day good Catholic schoolchildren are expected to join. The terrible polarity of Christian misogyny has found no more powerful expression than Sprenger's devotion both to the Virgin Mary and to torturing and burning innocent women for supposedly having sex with the devil. Of Kramer, less is known. He seems to have become interested in demons thanks to a chance encounter in Rome in 1460, when he met a priest who was possessed by the devil. It convinced him that it might be possible to find physical evidence of demons and so prove beyond all doubt that they were real. Kramer and Sprenger had a powerful accomplice in their campaign to prove that women were having sex with Satan. Pope Innocent VIII, 1484-92, had a reputation of being not so innocent. He was born Giovanni Battista Cibo, and contemporary chroniclers depict him as one given to unbridled licentiousness, who fathered several illegitimate children. He would spend the last weeks of his life unable to digest any food except woman's milk, an ironic fate for a man who, in effect, consigned untold thousands of innocent women to the flames. Kramer and Sprenger convinced the Pope with their tales of women copulating with demons, eating children, making men impotent, aborting fetuses, and killing cattle, that witchcraft was a serious threat to civilization and the Church. In 1484, the Pope issued a papal bull, which gave dogmatic force to the claims that witches were engaging in sex with demons. It declared, "It has indeed lately come to our ears, not without afflicting us with bitter sorrow, that in some parts of northern Germany, as well as in the provinces, townships, territories, districts, and dioceses of Mainz, Cologne, Treves, Salzburg, and Bremen, many persons of both sexes, unmindful of their own salvation and straying from the Catholic faith, have abandoned themselves to devils, incubi and succubi, and by their incantations, spells, conjurations, and other accursed charms and crafts, enormities, and horrid offences, have slain infants yet in the mother's womb, as also the offspring of cattle, have blasted the produce of the earth, the grapes of the vine. These wretches furthermore afflict and torment men and women. They hinder men from performing the sexual act, and women from conceiving, whence husbands cannot know their wives, nor wives receive their husbands. And at the instigation of the enemy of mankind, they do not shrink from committing and perpetrating foulest abominations and filthiest excesses to the deadly peril of their own souls. Wherefore we decree and enjoin that the aforesaid inquisitors, Kramer and Sprenger, be empowered to proceed to the just correction, imprisonment, and punishment of any persons, without let or hindrance, in every way." It was the equivalent of a declaration of war, and Malleus became a sort of justification for it. Women would be its chief victims. In the coming centuries, 80% of those executed in the witch hunts would be women. The inquisitors have a simple explanation for why it is that nearly all witches are women. "All witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which is in women insatiable," they write, citing Proverb 30. "There are three things that are never satisfied, yea, a fourth thing which says not it is enough, that is, the mouth of the womb. Wherefore, for the sake of fulfilling their lust, they consort even with the devil." They allege other faults in women that make them vulnerable to temptation, of course, including vanity, feeble-mindedness, talkativeness, and credulity. But in the minds of the inquisitors, women's greater carnality is the primary cause for witchcraft. Since presumably this fault identified as particular to women is not new, it might be asked why there are almost no reports of women copulating with the devil before 1400, when the Church decreed making love to demons a capital crime. Malleus has no explanation for this, other than to say that in the good old days, the incubus devils used to infest women against their wills. But modern witches willingly embrace this most foul and most miserable servitude. The claim that neither women nor witches are what they used to be is a grotesque version of the age-old lament uttered by every misogynist from Cato the Elder to the latest TV evangelist about the low morals of modern womanhood. It would have been comic if its consequences had not been so horrific. There is nothing comic about Malleus. It is written with all the deadly seriousness that cold fanaticism can muster, the sort that makes Hitler's Mein Kampf such a repulsive read. Nothing can make these two authors crack a smile, not even the tale of the missing penises. Bearing in mind that Sprenger and Kramer fault women for being the credulous sex, consider how they treat the accusation that witches steal penises. It is claimed that some witches collect penises in great numbers, as many as 20 or 30 together, and put them in a bird's nest or shut them up in a box, where they move themselves like living members and eat oats and corn. As proof, they claim that a certain man tells that, when he had lost his member, he approached a certain witch to ask her to restore his health. She told the afflicted man to climb a certain tree, and that he might take whichever member he liked out of a nest in which there were several members. And when he tried to take a big one, the witch said, "You must not take that one," adding, "because it belonged to a parish priest." In fact, what the Malleus has reproduced, clearly without realizing it, is a standard anti-clerical joke. According to the historian Walter Stevens, there are other instances of Kramers using jokes as if they were transcripts of court proceedings. The impression of insanity radiated by the Malleus comes from Kramer's willingness to believe almost anything as evidence that witchcraft and demons are real. There is speculation on whether or not others can see the incubi when witches are having sex with them. The inquisitors are also intrigued to know whether sex with a demon is more enjoyable for the woman than sex with her husband. In Malleus, there is evidence that sex with the devil is just as good, if not better than, sex with a man. This changed over the years. In witches' confessions from the 16th century onwards, though the devil's member gets bigger, like a mule's, long and thick as an arm, and even develops prongs so that she can have oral, anal, and vaginal sex all at once, sex with demons becomes much less pleasurable and even painful. The speculations of the inquisitors about sex with demons is almost entirely devoted to women and their incubi. Little is said about men making out with succubi. Kramer and Sprenger are not curious to know how enjoyable it is for a man to make love to a lady demon. That is because, they argue, men are not so prone to lusting after demons. And blessed be the highest who has so far preserved the male sex from so great a crime, they exclaim solemnly. The vocabulary of Malleus when it deals with human sexuality, and especially with women, is one of cold repugnance. It distances the authors from their subject as if the accusers did not belong to the same species as those whom they accuse of performing such acts of diabolical filthiness. Even more repellent is the chilling detachment the inquisitors display when they deal with the remedies for this high treason against God's majesty. It might be compared to the detachment of a Nazi bureaucrat totting up the daily death rate in a concentration camp. The institution of the Inquisition, into whose hands the accused fell, did indeed resemble the institutions of terror created by the totalitarian states of the 20th century. The job of the Inquisition was to find out and punish heretics. The person accused was not told by whom he or she had been accused. Legal representation was practically impossible. Anyone crazy enough to come to her legal defence is warned that he too might be condemned as a heretic. Those who endeavour to protect witches are their cruelest enemies, subjecting them to eternal flames in place of the transitory suffering of the stake, warns Peter Binsfield, the suffragan bishop of Trier, one of the areas worst affected by the witch hunts. The accused was imprisoned before being brought to trial, and while awaiting judgment, often for considerable periods of time, fed on a diet of bread and water. Torture was employed to extract confessions, and there was no appealing the sentence. The inquisitor was prosecutor, judge, and jury. Technically, the church did not actually carry out the sentence of death, since it is forbidden to take life. It merely relaxed its protection of the accused, if convicted. The victim was handed over to the civil authorities, who administered the punishment. The civil authorities, of course, could be certain to concur with the inquisitor's findings. Henry Kramer and James Sprenger sum up the church's role in a chilling phrase when they speak of those whom we have caused to be burned. The accused may be kept in a state of suspense by continually postponing the day of examination, the inquisitors advise. If this does not make her confess, let her first be led to the penal cells and there stripped by honest women of good character, in case she is concealing some instruments of witchcraft made from the limbs of unbaptized children. It is then a good idea to shave or burn off all her hair, except in Germany, where shaving, especially of the secret parts, is not generally considered delicate, and therefore we inquisitors do not use it. They are not so squeamish in other countries, where the inquisitors order the witch to be shaved all over her body. In northern Italy, the Malleus reports, The Inquisitor of Como has informed us that last year, that is in 1485, he ordered 41 witches to be burned after they had been shaved all over. The unmistakable relish Kramer and Sprenger derive from stressing this detail betrays the underlying sadism. If the squalor of the prison and the humiliation of stripping and shaving, never mind the mounting terror as she awaits the coming torture, do not break her, the judge should order the officers to bind her with cords and apply her to some engine of torture, and then let them obey at once, but not joyfully, rather appearing to be disturbed by their duty. Usually the first instrument of torture applied was the strappado. Her hands are tied beneath her back. She is roped to a pulley and then yanked violently into the air, where she is jerked up and down until her shoulders are dislocated and her sinews torn. And while she is raised above the ground, the inquisitors write, with the detachment of civil servants, if she is being tortured in this way, let the judge read or cause to be read to her the dispositions of the witnesses with their names, saying, "See, you are convicted by the witnesses." If she is still obstinate, other tortures can be used. She might be burned with candles or with hot oil. Flaming balls of pitch might be applied to her genitals, or gallons of water forced down her throat until she is bloated, and the officers then beat her belly with sticks. She can be forced to sit on the witch's chair, a sort of narrow cage with clamps and a spiked seat. Thumbscrews and other devices for crushing the legs and feet might be used. Some victims were held in irons so long in filthy conditions that they died of gangrene before coming to trial. However, the inquisitors are not without sympathy. They forbid torturing pregnant women. They are to be tortured only after giving birth. Cheating and lying are also permitted to the judges. A judge may promise the woman that he will spare her life, then, once she has confessed, hand her over for sentencing to another judge. Or a judge may come in and promise that he will be merciful, with the mental reservation that he means that he will be merciful to himself or the state, for whatever is done for the safety of the state is merciful. As in 20th century totalitarianism, things become their opposite according to the dictates of the regime. It reminds us of the nightmare world of George Orwell's 1984, with its dominant slogans, "War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength." The authors of Malleus might add, "Cruelty is mercy." And as in Nazi Germany and Stalinist Russia, it was held to be acceptable for children and parents to denounce each other. Peter Binsfield tells the story of an 18-year-old boy who denounced his mother out of filial piety. She went to the stake, along with three of her children, in November 1588. Once the accused is convicted, the church decrees she suffers relaxation to the secular arm. That is, it hands her over to the civil authorities for punishment, which meant painful death. There is little hope that the secular arm will oppose the church's will. A French demonologist warns, "The judge who does not put to death a convicted witch should be put to death himself." On her way to the stake, the woman was often forced to wear the witch's bridle, a spiked iron gag jammed and locked in her mouth to stifle her screams and her protests of innocence. By such methods, over a period of some 200 years, an unknown number of women were executed, mostly by being burned alive. Overall, it has been impossible to gauge the number of victims who died as witches. Estimates range from several millions to around 60,000. The numbers and some of the methods varied from country to country. The witch hunts raged most violently in Germany, Switzerland, France, and Scotland. However, within those countries, the numbers executed varied considerably from area to area. In France, the witch hunts tended to concentrate in areas such as the southwest, where previously heresies such as Catharism had flourished. The same was true of Germany. The major witch hunts broke out along religious fault lines that produced the upheavals of the Reformation and the religious wars of the 1600s. In the area of southwest Germany, between 1561 and 1670, 3,229 witches were burned. Around the town of Wiesentaig, in 1 year, 1662, 63 women were burned, that is, at the rate of more than one per week. Near Trier, in 1585, after the Catholics had reclaimed it from the Protestants, two villages were left with only one woman each, all the rest having been burned. Nicholas Remy, a scholar, a Latin poet, author of De Mona Latreia, as well as an inquisitor, burned between 2,000 and 3,000 witches before dying in 1616. Between 1628 and 1631, Philip Adolf von Ehrenberg burned 900 witches, including several children. At this time, also in Germany, children as young as 3 and 4 were accused of having sex with devils. Children who had been convicted of attending the witches' Sabbath with their parents were flogged in front of the stake as their mother and father burned. Jean Baudin, the author of the 1580 treatise De la Démonomanie Dissociée, writes, "Children guilty of witchcraft, if convicted, are not to be spared, though, in consideration of their tender age, they may, if penitent, be strangled before being burnt." Girls above the age of 12 and boys over 14 were treated as adults. In England, approximately 1,000 witches were executed during a 200-year period, far fewer than in most other parts of Europe gripped by the craze. Demonic copulation was generally not a feature of the accusations, and the kind of torture that was authorised on the continent was forbidden. Instead, the accused were deprived of sleep for days at a time until they confessed. English women's sexual embrace of the devil coincided with the arrival of the Puritan Matthew Hopkins as witchfinder general during the English Civil War, 1642-9. Up until then, they had apparently been content to suckle demonic toads and cats at their breasts. Hopkins hung some 200 women as witches in 14 months, including 19 in one day in the town of Chelmsford, Essex. One of his victims, Rebecca West of Colchester, accused of killing a child by witchcraft, confessed to have married the devil. Hopkins was paid a bounty for each witch he hanged, and legend has it he retired a rich man. Just north of the border in Scotland, however, where continental-style torture prevailed, copulation with the devil was as common as it was in France, Switzerland, northern Italy, and Germany. Scottish witches also confessed regularly to eating their children. 4,000 were burned during the years of the witch hunts, a horrific level given Scotland's sparse population. The English Puritans brought the fear of witchcraft with them to the New World. They brought with them, too, something of the Old World misogyny that was its inspiration. But the witch craze never caught on with the same ferocity in the colonies as it did in Europe. There were only two intense outbreaks, the first in Hartford, Connecticut, 1662-3, and the second, and more infamous, in Salem, Massachusetts, for a few months beginning in December in 1691. In Hartford, 13 were accused and 4 hanged, and in Salem, 200 were accused and 19 hanged. As in Europe, 4/5 of the victims were women. A half of the males who were accused were husbands or sons of witches. The conviction rate was far lower than that of the European witch hunts. A more democratic system of justice prevailed, allowing those convicted to appeal to higher courts. The outbreaks endured for a far shorter period. The majority of the cases concerned acts of possession. There was only one instance, in 1651, of a woman accused of going to bed with the devil, and she only did so when he appeared to her in the form of her lost child. At an official level, scepticism prevailed very rapidly. Within a generation of the Salem trials, a man and wife who accused one Sarah Spencer of witchcraft were sent to see a doctor in order to establish whether or not they were sane. Undoubtedly, one of the reasons that the persecution of witches in North America lasted for so short a time was the fact that Old World misogyny did not enjoy a completely successful transplant to the New World. The Puritan tradition shared something of the early Christians' belief in equality before the Lord. Women enjoyed a higher status in the colonies. 2 centuries after the witch craze had passed, Alexis de Tocqueville, 1805-59, observed that in America, while they have allowed the social inferiority of woman to continue, they have done all they could to raise her morally and intellectually to the level of man, and in this respect they appear to me to have excellently understood the true principle of democratic improvement. That great democratic experiment that had its roots in the 17th century's social and religious radicalism helped protect women from the worst excesses of the witch craze. The last woman to be legally executed as a witch was burned in Switzerland in 1787. In 1793, a woman in Poland was burned, but illegally. By then, the craze had long ago run its course. The threat from the devil and his legions of female devotees had vanished. We now read the writings of Cramer and Sprenger and the other demonologists and inquisitors with utter incredulity, mixed with horror and disgust. The question remains, how is it that women came to be demonized for close to 300 years in a society where learning and the arts were entering one of their most fruitful periods, and the scientific, philosophical, and social revolutions in Europe would soon transform forever how people viewed themselves and the world? Another way of looking at this question is to ask why it was that misogyny, so long a fundamental element in Christian thinking, took on its most lethal form at a time otherwise associated with great human progress. The historian Walter Stevens argues that doubt, not misogyny, lay at the root of the witch hunt craze. The profound intellectual, social, and moral changes that were shaking society challenged people's faith, and they sought ways to vindicate their traditional beliefs in the old divine order. In his detailed analysis of Malleus, Stevens argues that the preoccupation with women having sex with demons was mainly a concern with finding evidence that demons existed. The more detail they could get from women's alleged experiences, the better. The Inquisitors' sexual obsessions about women, that to the modern sensibility resemble pornographic fantasies, are really a desperate quest for proof that will ward off uncertainty. The expert testimony of witches themselves has made all these things credible, the Malleus asserts. That is, Inquisitors tortured women in a search for evidence that the devil really existed. They sought to transform their metaphysics into physics. The witch hunt was a hideous experiment to make unobservable entities real. Confirming their existence confirmed that the whole world of the spirit was actual and not just a fantasy. Stevens agrees that there was a misogynistic dimension, and that Christianity's long history of contempt of and hostility towards women led to many more of them being arrested and tortured than men. But it was the search for proof that was the primary motivation for the horrors of those years. Even if we accept the argument that misogyny was a secondary motive for the witch hunt, it does nothing to mitigate the appalling picture that it presents. It merely means that many thousands of women perished in the flames and at the end of a rope in order to assuage men's doubts. The flames affirmed the dualism of Christianity, inherited from Plato, which saw the everyday world as contemptible and the world of the spirit as the true reality. For women, dualism could not have had a more horrific consequence. At least three conditions conspired to create the emotional, moral, and social context for the witch hunts. First, the 14th century, which ushered them in, was, like the 5th century BC in Greece and the 3rd century AD in the Roman Empire, a period of terrible calamities. Plague and war threatened to unhinge society. Fear and doubt caused people to view the world in a darker and more sinister light. Secondly, heretics, real and imagined, threatened a once seemingly all-powerful institution, the Church, and its claims to embody the absolute truth. Finally, Christian society's deep-seated misogyny provided the needed scapegoat in the form of woman. Just as centuries of Christian anti-Semitism provided the ideological grounds for the Nazi Holocaust, so the long tradition of contempt for and dehumanization of women made the witch hunts possible. The crises of the 14th century passed, but the crises confronting the Catholic Church did not. With the Reformation, the great edifice that had endured for more than 1,000 years cracked apart. The new Protestant churches proved themselves every bit as fanatical about witch-hunting as the Catholics they reviled. But there was a deeper crisis gathering that would one day threaten the whole Christian worldview. The first tremor came in 1543, with the publication of On the Revolutions, by Nicolaus Copernicus, a quiet, cautious priest, who, knowing the import of what he wrote, ensured that it would only be made public after he was dead and safely out of the reach of the Inquisition. Copernicus set the earth in motion around the sun. The ground moved under the very intellectual foundations of Christianity. We were no longer at the centre of a fixed, unchanging cosmos as ordained by God and Aristotle. It was a queasy feeling from which Christianity would never recover. Witchcraft retains its fascination in modern times. The success of the many movies and books about witches and witchcraft, most recently the Harry Potter novels, indicate their still powerful fascination. But what is astonishing is not that witchcraft should retain, at some level, its appeal in modern times, but that misogyny should. This is typified by the Reverend Montague Summers, the only English translator of Malleus Maleficarum, who, it seemed, welcomed the misogyny of Sprenger and Kramer. Though feminists and scholars have often quoted from his text, his introduction is generally ignored. In it, Reverend Summers thoroughly approves of the job undertaken by Sprenger and Kramer, and wishes they were still around to deal with the rise of socialism, of which he sees witchcraft as a forerunner. He notes the misogynistic trend of various passages, but he writes they are a wholesome and needful antidote in this feministic age when the sexes seem confounded and it appears to be the chief object of many females to ape the man. This extraordinary condoning of the demonization and mass murder of women was written in 1928, 9 or 10 years after women received the vote in the United States and Britain. In recent years, many crimes perpetrated by states and other organizations, including those against women, have been acknowledged, and those responsible for them have in some cases apologized to the descendants of their victims. For example, in 1431, a 19-year-old French peasant girl called Joan, who had heard God's voice instructing her to lead the armies of France against the English, which she did with remarkable success, was condemned and burned as a heretic. To her English captors, the voice she had heard was not God's, but Satan's. She was also condemned as an enchantress, that is, a witch. Joan of Arc is the only witch that the Church has rehabilitated and made into a saint. The Church has since apologized, through the Pope, to the Jews for its anti-Semitism, and just a few years ago to Galileo the astronomer for persecuting him because of his assertion that Copernicus was right in arguing that it is the sun, not the earth, which is at the center of the solar system. "Great evils form the groundwork of history," wrote the medievalist Herzinger. Is it not time for the Pope to set an example for other Christians and acknowledge the great evil of the witch hunts, the awful wrongs inflicted upon thousands of innocent women, recognize their innocence, and apologize for their horrendous deaths?